You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. The Oxford Executive MBA enables current and future business leaders to make a difference in their chosen field. The part-time program is designed to fit alongside your work commitments and offers you a global network. Visit the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford website for further details. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast, episode 39. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. If you're interested in our podcast, you might also find our regular articles, blogs, and other written publications of interest. Just visit our website, www.socialeurope.eu, to read our latest output. If you want to stay up to date with all things Social Europe, just sign up to our regular newsletter. You can do so on our website. Now, without further ado, here's Social Europe Podcast, episode 39. Our topic today is understanding Brexit and the future of the EU-UK relationship, and I'm talking to Anna Menon, who is Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London. He was also appointed in January 2014 as Director of the UK in a Changing Europe initiative, and he was a Special Advisor to the House of Lords EU Committee. Anna Menon, thank you very much for taking the time in your undoubtedly very busy schedule to talk to me today about Brexit. And I'm trying to achieve something very different today. Get away from the day-to-day politics of Brexit and trying to look at some of the underlying trends and dynamics. So if you step back for a moment, I mean, you've done a lot of research by now on Brexit and how it all started. So, you know, looking back at the referendum and the run up to the referendum, what would you say were actually the key drivers that determined the Brexit result? And, you know, which ones of these drivers were actually real drivers and which ones were basically perceptions that really don't necessarily correspond with what is happening in reality?
Well, I think the perceptions point is really interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, post-referendum, lots of different myths have taken hold. You know, Brexit was the result of the left behind, and so on and so forth. And actually, what the data shows, perhaps unsurprisingly about the referendum, is the outcomes stem from a whole host of different and sometimes contradictory causes. So what do we know? We know that immigration was a serious issue for some people, not for all Leave voters, but for some Leave voters. We know that the young overwhelmingly tended to vote Remain. We also know that the young tend to be better qualified than the older cohorts just because more people go to university. So there's that overlap with educational qualification. And we also know, of course, that there was a broad sort of cross-class coalition that voted Brexit. Brexit wasn't simply the left behind, though people in places that weren't doing so well were disproportionately more likely to vote for Brexit. But actually, what all this points to is the fact that one of the very good reasons why Brexit is proving so hard to implement is because the reasons for Brexit are so varied, and some of them actually are cross-cutting and contradictory.
And you mentioned a few of them, but I mean, what is the latest explanation? So how would you explain to people outside of the UK who might not have followed all the ins and outs of Brexit, you know, how can it be that, you know, in most models, you have the expectation of a rational voter, that people say in Wales or in the Northeast, no, maybe not obviously, but at least on the surface, voted against their own economic interests. Are they putting sort of cultural factors ahead of economic ones, or sort of what is the key to understand this?
Well, certainly cultural factors played their part, and a fear about immigration played its part, and a fear about immigration based on issues to do with identity rather than economics as well. But what I would say as well is I think one of the problems that the Remain campaign faced is it itself and many of those who acted as spokespeople for it were no longer believed or trusted. And you've got to put this in the context of a Britain that's still going through the aftermath of the financial crisis, where austerity is in full flow, where despite the fact that austerity was in full flow, we have a chancellor, George Osborne, who never tired of saying we're all in this together, even though the economic data showed that this was patently untrue. And where people had stopped believing the line that they heard from so often from politicians, that the economy is recovering, the economy is doing fine, because actually their own lived experience was wages were stagnant, the price of living was going up, and that whilst England, the southeast of England might have been doing relatively well and might have recovered relatively quickly, much of the rest of the country wasn't. So there was an economic aspect to it as well, and that was rooted, I think, in the fact that people either didn't believe what they were being told, or when they heard the aggregate figures, simply thought, well, what's GDP got to do with me? I remember one instance very, very clearly from the referendum campaign where one of the spokespeople for Remain was giving a press conference and basically said, look, we've got to be very careful about this. If we vote to leave the European Union, then the City of London will be hurt and house prices will fall. And I remember on my Facebook feed, I mean, I come from the north of England, a place that was predominantly Leave voting. All my school friends were going, yes, fantastic. Cheaper houses and a rebalancing of the economy away from the city. We'll take that. So there were a lot of competing economic interests at play.
And one of the quite interesting things is, I mean, how would you explain sort of, to somebody how this sort of anti-elite sentiment that took hold could actually be used by people who were quite obviously part of the elite. I mean, Nigel Farage being the cheerleader of the anti-elite, or later on, Michael Gove, saying he's got enough of experts, and Boris Johnson playing a similar tune. I mean, how did they pull that off? And why did actually people believe them, which is basically just a splinter group of the elite then turning against their former colleagues, effectively?
No, that's absolutely true. And I think experience tells us that basically people don't really care what sort of school Nigel Farage went to. They find his message appealing. He's a tremendously good political sort of charismatic political leader. And we see this already. He's just created a new party. They're already at the top of the polls for the European Parliament elections, which is remarkable by any measure. But I think also you've got to just bear in mind that on top of the impact of the financial crisis, the other thing that was absolutely fundamental to the sort of context in which Brexit played out was the fact that if you go back to 2008, we had the MPs' expenses crisis, faith in politics had taken a hit. And anyone who seemed like an outsider, and you can think here of Trump in the United States, he's hardly part of, that core working class vote that helped him get over the line. But he spoke a language they liked, and a language that was anti the establishment, anti the people who'd been in charge for so long. And that proved remarkably effective. There was a correlation between your likeliness to vote leave and how much you distrusted politicians in this country.
I mean, this clearly applies to Farage and as you rightly say, also to Trump. But I mean, how did Michael Gove, Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg have been, by any standards, part of the political establishment well before all of this came about? How did they pull this off, that they come across us, as the anti-elite representative?
Well, I think there are several things at play here. Jacob Rees-Mogg wasn't that much of a central figure during the referendum campaign itself, remember. I mean, he's risen to prominence subsequent to the referendum. In the case of Boris Johnson, he's always been a slightly strange political beast. He's been referred to as a Heineken politician, the sort of politician that can reach places other conservatives cannot reach. And as such, because he's a clown-like figure, I think people like that, because he's not seen as part of the uber-serious, jargon-ridden Westminster crowd that, according to many people, had already failed them. And Michael Gove, I think, in a sense, what he did was he reassured the Tory heartland. Remember, the majority of these people who voted Brexit were Tory voters. I mean, it was the shires and the sort of prosperous parts of Britain that voted Leave as well as the poorer parts of Britain, or had Leave voters as much as the poorer parts of Britain. And I think what Gove did was added what those people saw as a degree of intellectual heft. That is to say, if someone is serious and as obviously clever as Michael Gove can back this, there must be a point to it. So I think what the Leave campaign managed quite well, sometimes despite themselves, I think, was a balance that on the one hand, you have the official Leave campaign, which is Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage and Michael Gove. They kept their distance from the unofficial Leave campaign led by Nigel Farage. But those two groups appeal to vastly different audiences. And between them, they created this coalition that got Leave just over the line.
And I mean, maybe the last bit about the campaign and the referendum. There was obviously the Cambridge Analytica scandal coming out last year, and you know, I'm wondering about this. I mean, we've heard a lot about the impact of advertising, you know, psychometric data, targeting, and so on and so forth on the outcome of the campaign. How would you evaluate this, given that I mean, in most polling that I've seen, the camps are relatively stable. I mean, you've got a few percentage points one way or the other, but I mean, as at least the last time I looked, there wasn't a massive sort of landslide shift in the Remain direction or anything like that. So I mean, how would you square that you know, social media has had this impact, and even though now it's been revealed as, you know, what it's done, you still have relatively stable camps.
Yeah, well, let me start with the numbers and then get on to the technology. I think in the numbers, you're absolutely right. If you look in the longer term, I think for 4 or 5 years before the referendum and up to and including the referendum, the numbers had stayed roughly the same. Not many people had changed their minds by the time of the referendum. In fact, it looks like that campaign itself changed relatively few minds. What did matter, I think, was differential turnout. What the Leave vote, Leave campaign did very effectively was they got people who either had never voted or had stopped voting to register and turn out to vote. And you see this in the differential turnout levels. I think something like 2.8 million people who hadn't voted in the general election in 2015 voted in the referendum of 2016. So I think that made a massive difference to the outcome in the end, that mobilization of the Leave vote. When it comes to the technology, I mean, Henning, you know me, you know what a Luddite I am, and I'm not going to start commenting on what algorithms can do to the way people think. I'd say several things. Firstly, it is obviously true that people try to change people's minds using things like Facebook. It is equally true, I think, and cannot be denied, that in this country, we need better laws to protect us against that. Our laws are very, very 20th century. Our electoral laws and so on and so forth. And we need to find a way of tracking and keeping an eye on sort of social media, political advertising that disappears after it's been targeted at groups. So it's very hard to track and very hard to prove anything afterwards. I have not seen anything that convinces me that enormous numbers of people changed their minds or were motivated to vote because of this kind of online advertising. That's not to say it didn't happen. It's just to say I haven't seen any clear evidence that it has happened. Maybe that evidence, I imagine that evidence is very, very hard to find just by the nature of the data you'd have to collect. But I would not deny for a moment there's a problem. My fear about this debate around Cambridge Analytica is partly a fear that it provides an excuse for Remainers. They were hoodwinked, they were tricked, it was Russian bots, it was Russian propaganda. I think the danger of that is it distracts attention from the fact that there were many genuine grievances that lay behind the Brexit vote. And one of the things we need to be thinking about is how to address those grievances, whether we end up staying or leaving. And we can't simply say, oh, look, if it wasn't for a few Facebook adverts, these people wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, and maybe this is not mutually exclusive. Maybe rather than sort of turning minds, the social media campaign has actually created what you mentioned, a higher turnout in one of the camps. I mean, if you see sort of the kind of advertising that, you know, the whole of Turkey's at the gates. So we have to do something about this. So that might have been sort of the trigger then, rather than, you know, changing people's minds, prompting them to register. True.
So that's a slightly separate point in the sense that that was, you know, I remember that being said on television. I remember going on television during the referendum campaign on the day that Penny Mordaunt said on the Andrew Marr show that that Britain would not have a veto on Turkish entry to the European Union. And I remember going on the news that evening and saying, yes, we would. That's not true. I think part of that is another question, which is about how do you deal with inaccurate statements in political campaigns? That, again, is something we might want to think about. And I think it's separate to but related to the issue of technology. And that I haven't seen a very, very convincing answer. I mean, we've heard about sort of having commissions to monitor the truth of claims made. The problem with that is in much political campaigning, claims are being made about the future. And there aren't any facts about the future. So it is very, very hard to fact check claims about the future, and that is problematic. Though in that specific example, what was said was obviously untrue.
Yeah, because it was a procedural point. I mean, because Britain would have a veto, right? So, I mean, that was just a procedure. But, you know, the advertising was literally, and I remember Farage doing the same thing. So we now have an open door policy to 450 million people or something like that, right? So
yeah.
if of course, if everybody in the European Union decided one, from one day to the other to move to the UK and empty all the other lands, that's theoretically true. Practical, obviously,
no,
impossible.
No, absolutely. And one has to wonder why, you know, why would you leave Istanbul to come to Britain for a start? But I mean, also, of course, what was interesting about some of the more nefarious parts of the campaign was it wasn't Europeans that they showed. Their breaking point poster was about immigrants into the European Union and the argument that they would immediately find their way to Britain, which, of course, was also misleading because, of course, we're not in Schengen. There's no open border there. Those people will be stopped at the border anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting topic, and I think we only scratched the surface of that. I mean, there's obviously much more to come in this arena. But let me move on to the actual Brexit process, the glorious one, that we have the fun of getting extensions over and over again. I mean, I remember the week after the referendum, I had a letter to the editor published in the Financial Times. And at the time, it was already becoming clear what I think has really played out since, that Theresa May, who was nominally a Remainer, saw the opportunity to become Prime Minister, but only if she interpreted the result in the harshest possible terms in order to sound tough and, you know, I'm not going to repeat Brexit means Brexit, but that basically, you know, she wanted to paint herself as a reluctant Remainer. She did it for economic reasons, but now she understood the mandate that was given by the referendum and then came up with the red lines and, you know, triggered Article 50 prematurely without a strategy. So how would your assessment of the process, of the governmental process, we'll come to Parliament in a second, of the governmental process, how would the assessment be?
Well, I mean, you've talked very much about the first phase, which is interesting. And let's dwell for a moment on Theresa May as a figure. I think there are several things worth saying about Theresa May. Firstly, I think you're right, is that she came to power as a reluctant Remainer and therefore felt the need as soon as she came in, and particularly by the time we get to October of that year in the Conservative Party conference, to sing to the Brexit choir, okay? So she had to prove her credentials to the European Research Group, who are the hardcore Brexit group inside the Conservative Party. And one interesting hypothetical we can ask is, would this process have played out differently had a Leaver become Prime Minister in July 2016? You could make the case, for instance, in a kind of only Nixon could go to China sort of logic, that a Leaver would have found it far easier to make compromises to go for a soft Brexit than someone who was tainted by having been a Remainer. So that's the first thing. Having a Remainer is problematic. The second thing I would say about Theresa May is, for all her years in government, she clearly didn't get trade very well and didn't understand how trade worked very well, which was why she, by the time she gets to October and that Conservative Party conference, she was able to say, we're leaving the single market, we're leaving the customs union, but we're going to have frictionless trade and we're going to have no border in the island of Ireland. There was a flagrant contradiction between the different things she said, because I don't think she had as yet figured out what the details of single market and customs union meant. I think she's come to realize, we can talk about that in a minute, where she's got to, but at the time she didn't get it. And the third thing I think, which was crucial, was that Theresa May's immediate experience of the European Union was her experience as Home Secretary discussing the British opt-outs from Justice and Home Affairs, where, of course, Britain had got this special privilege in the Lisbon Treaty where it could decide to opt in to certain measures of Justice and Home Affairs as it saw fit. And I think one of the things that Theresa May did was she assumed that the whole thing worked like that. We'll just tick the boxes we want to be in. The European Union will say yes, and then it'll be fine. We'll have the bits we want. We won't have the bits we don't want. And, of course, what she realized very, very quickly indeed was it doesn't work like that. You can't just have bits of it and not other bits. The European Union has its own red lines, and some of them it will not let you cross.
I mean, that's an interesting point that you mentioned. I mean, given that it was a speech at a party conference, do you think that nobody sort of fact-checked it? And I mean, because this is not a sort of an error in detail, but, you know, saying, you know, we're going to get out of the customs union, going to get out of the single market, but, you know, everything will remain frictionless. It's a major error. And also, I mean, She might have gambled in a way that she thought, you know, oh yeah, the European Union might say that the four freedoms are indivisible, but in the end they will, you know, they will come around. But, you know, given David Cameron's experience with exactly this, you know, trying to negotiate, especially around, you know, freedom of movement. I mean, she must have known, one would have thought that, you know, this was a hard red line for the European Union.
I suppose you could have made the case that, yes, what was true for a member state might not be true of a former member state. So maybe there's more flexibility. But I actually think one of the great problems around the early phases of Brexit was the fact that she only met her European counterparts formally at the European Council after that Conservative Party conference. Because, of course, at the first European Council meeting after the referendum, David Cameron went. He'd already stated his intention to resign. He didn't have a successor as yet, so he went along to that meeting. So she hadn't actually been to the European Council and talked to her counterparts and got a sense of the mood in the room before she made that speech to the Conservative Party conference. And I do sometimes wonder whether it might have been better to try and have an emergency council in September so that she could have met them and we could have known where everyone stood before she started laying down those red lines.
Yeah, and obviously later on, you know, triggering Article 50 without having a sort of... A clear idea of where to go.
No, I agree with that. I mean, she's not alone in that, because I remember on the day after the referendum, Jeremy Corbyn saying we should trigger Article 50 today.
True, yeah.
So she wasn't alone. And I think also we've got to bear in mind the political context of the time. She was under massive pressure from the Brexit wing of her party to trigger Article 50, because even back then they were fearing betrayal and that this process wouldn't be triggered. And so it was the wrong decision to make. You're absolutely right. You needed to have a plan. You needed to have a strategy. You needed to have had some chats with European leaders to know where you were going. But she was forced into it by political pressure. I should also say that part of the issue here was the European Union's refusal to discuss the future before the past was sorted out. Now, you can understand tactically why the European Union did that. I do wonder, given where we are now, though, whether or not there might be people on the other side of the channel who are thinking, well, hang on, we could have had an in-principle discussion about the future, got something cleared up before we started the formal process, because that would have made things easier to sell to the Prime Minister and we could have actually made it clearer to her what direction she needed to go in. Now, I understand what the fears were on the EU side, and I think the fear was primarily that if we had trade negotiations at the same time as Article 50 negotiations, the British government would immediately link the payment of the Brexit liability to what we got in the trade deal. And they've managed very successfully to keep those separate. But if this ends in a no deal outcome, I wonder if there are going to be people thinking, actually, we could have been a bit more flexible on that.
Yeah, and I think part of this story was also that, you know, it was not just a talk about, you know, the pre-negotiations before the official triggering of Article 50, but it was also an attempt by May, as far as I could tell, to try to divide and rule. Because I remember, you know, and I was an affected EU citizen at the time in London, right? Sitting now in Berlin, I remember she, you know, May coming to Angela Merkel here in Berlin, trying to settle the EU citizens' status straight away. And then later on in the media, it was portrayed, well, Merkel said no, and, you know, May had the moral high ground. But in effect, what she tried to do is not just pre-negotiate with the EU27, but with the most important, arguably, member state and trying to make a bilateral deal with Merkel, and basically trying to divide the EU27 before it actually started. And that was exactly the reason why Merkel said, well, we can talk about this on day one of the official negotiations amongst all of us. Right, yep. But not bilaterally with you in Berlin. So I mean, it would have been clearly beneficial with the, you know, with the information and the benefit of hindsight, to have amongst all of them better talks before.
No, I agree, and I think actually one of the interesting things about the EU position for me is the paradox that I think it was fear of disunity that led to this amazing unity. That is to say, you know, member state governments understood all too well that if they allowed May to do what she wanted to do and talk to them separately, what would happen was they'd end up in different places because they have different interests. And so because of that, it was because of the fear of disunity that they said, OK, talk to the Commission because we don't trust ourselves not to contradict each other. And that strategy worked remarkably well.
Yeah, well, true. I mean, who would have thought that? Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's move to the after the role of government to the very interesting, more recent role of Parliament. Mm-hmm. And one of your former colleagues at Oxford, Andreas Busch, made an interesting statement on German television here the other day. Given that also, you know, Parliament doesn't quite know what to do, it only knows what it doesn't want, is he said that there is an interesting conflict here because actually two sovereignty principles are clashing. In the British political system, you have parliamentary sovereignty. That's you know, the fundamental basis of the system. But the referendum, even though it was legally just an advisory referendum, and you know, with all the problems that have come out since, but it was basically popular sovereignty now clashing with parliamentary sovereignty. I mean, is that how you see it as well? I mean, how do these dynamics play out?
I'm slightly suspicious of these Parliament versus the people narratives. I mean, we're going to hear a lot of them in the weeks to come because, of course, the irony is that the big Remainer Party, Change UK, and the big Brexit Party, the Brexit Party, are going to spin this line that politicians are sort of somehow betraying the people or letting the people down and that politics needs to change. I see it differently. I think in a curious way that Parliament is very accurately reflecting the state of the British people. Parliament is angry. It's bored of Brexit. It's polarized. It doesn't know what it wants. It's divided down the middle. And that is a pretty accurate reflection of where the British people are. In a curious kind of way, if Parliament had found Brexit easy, there would be something wrong with Parliament because the British people can't agree on anything to do with Brexit. You see the depolarization in the surveys. You see it's very hard to get majorities for any single kind of outcome, though there is now a slight majority for Remain, according to the opinion polls. Parliament is reflecting the fact that this is a very difficult, very divisive issue. And bear in mind, I mean, just, you know, I don't want to sound like the great defender of MPs, but let's just bear a couple of things in mind about Brexit. Firstly, it is a nightmare to do. And it is particularly a nightmare to do in the rather absurd 2-year timetable that the treaty sets. 2 years is a very short amount of time to unpick a 40-year relationship. The second thing that makes Brexit uniquely difficult is it cuts through the heart of the Labour and Conservative parties. It mobilises another cleavage in society, not left versus right, but social liberal versus social authoritarian. And that makes party management far, far harder than it is on traditional matters of economic policy. And so Brexit is uniquely difficult for Parliament to deal with. And it's even more so because Parliament, reflecting the people, is profoundly divided, deeply polarized, and a very angry place before Easter, at least. We'll see what it's like today.
Yeah, I mean, you say basically the legitimacy basis doesn't matter because basically the conflict is that the people and Parliament, as representatives of people, don't really know which way to go.
Absolutely.
That's the difficulty. Okay, well, again, staying away from day-to-day politics after the Easter break, how do you see this playing out between now and, say, the end of October, which is the, I would say, preliminary deadline? Now, I wouldn't put too much money on that being the hard deadline. But, you know, how likely do you see, would you see, given the sort of incentives or the party logics behind it, is there a real chance that there is a sort of deal between the Conservatives and Labour? Because that seems to be the prerequisite to get a majority for anything in Parliament. Or how do you see this playing out in the next few months?
I think it is conceivable, at least, that there might be consensus between Labour and the Tories on process. So the two teams might agree on a parliamentary process designed to end the deadlock. I do not see any prospect of a consensus between the two parties on substance, because both parties know that they're in danger of splitting if they give in to the demands of the other. If Theresa May gives in to a permanent customs union, and we can discuss whether or not actually the backstop already is one, and so this debate is ridiculous, but if she gives in to the phraseology of a permanent customs union, her party might split. If the Labour Party move closer to the Tory party without talk of a referendum, they're in real danger. So I don't see neither side wants to be the one to walk away. Both sides realize that people's trust in and faith in politics is plummeting. Deborah Mattison, who's head of the polling organization Britain Think, says today in one of the newspapers, in 30 years of working on public opinion, she's never known trust in politics to be so low. So neither party wants to be the one to walk away from the table, but equally neither party is going to find it hard to agree. So I imagine these talks will drag on fairly pointlessly for a while yet, but not come to any clear resolution. Thereafter, I think the European elections could prove enormously disruptive. Because, for instance, let me give you one hypothetical. Nigel Farage's new Brexit party wins. It becomes the biggest party, or it secures the most MEPs, or it gets the highest amount of the vote share. That changes the debate in the UK pretty significantly, because in a sense, it puts us back to 2014, where David Cameron is trying to appease Brexit supporters because of the danger of the Conservative Party splitting. Already today, just before I spoke to you, I saw on Twitter that there was a Conservative MP tweeting about how fantastic the list of candidates that the Brexit Party had put together, which is curious in our politics. An MP from one party singing the praises of another party. So that these elections could prove to be enormously significant for how the Brexit debate unfolds thereafter.
Yeah, and obviously last time around, 2014, UKIP already won the highest vote share, didn't it? And
yeah.
And if I read correctly, Jacob Rees-Mogg's sister is running on the list of Farage's Brexit Party.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So there is a lot of sort of, they're not as far apart, but you know, you can, but let me dwell on the point that you mentioned before, because that really gets us into the next point I wanted to touch upon. Is given that trust in politics is at its lowest in living memory. I mean, given that division and given that this division in British society has already been apparent for, 3 years, what do you think are the long-term consequences of this division, you know, within British society? What are the social and political consequences of this?
Well, I'm not one of those people who says, oh, look, we've got to fear civil disobedience or violence or anything like that. But what I think the political consequences are, we're in for 5 to 10 years of very rocky, potentially rather populist politics. That's partly a function of the leadership of the two big parties. It's partly a function of the divisions in the two big parties, but partly a function, too, that we now have alternatives springing up that are explicitly anti-politics. And I can see a phase in our politics now that will last long before we leave, long after we leave the European Union, if we leave it, that will be very, very unsettled indeed in terms of British politics.
And I mean, obviously, there's been quite a bit of discussion about, you know, given that there has already been violence in the referendum campaign when Joe Cox was murdered, and you know, Farage going around saying, you know, putting the fear of God in MPs for being traitors. I mean, that kind of language, do you see it is actually becoming worse in the run-up to the European elections now? And, you know, can it get even rougher?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think the language has got out of hand. I think, you know, it's not just Farage. I think some Conservative MPs use the language of appeasement, of betrayal, of mutiny. I think this stokes up passions. I don't think it's very helpful. I don't think it's very conducive to good political debate. I think it's very irresponsible on their part. Sadly, it's become a way of life here. I mean, it's all the more true on social media, of course, where some of the abuse suffered by particularly female MPs is truly horrific. But the tone has coarsened. I realize I sound like a parent now. The tone has coarsened considerably. And I do think the serious point here is that is not good for the standard of political debate or for the health of the body politic.
Hmm. And, you know, what do you think? How is this playing out? I mean, you already said, you know, if Britain leaves the European Union, I mean, what would be the cornerstones of a sort of solid and collegial post-Brexit, if it happens, relationship between the UK and the European Union? And what do you think would be the chances of Brexit actually not happening at all, given how this is all playing out?
Well, I think the cornerstone of a more collegial Brexit is to avoid no deal at all costs, because I think if we end up with no deal, we're going to end up with poisonous relationships between the UK and the European Union, because, of course, the narrative will take root here, to the extent it hasn't already, that the Europeans have done this to us on purpose because they wanted to harm us. And I think it'll take a long time for political relations to recover from that. Even if Britain does end up coming back on bended knee to ask for a solution to no deal, it will do tremendous harm here. And I suspect my real fear about that is that harm won't be confined to arguing with the European Union, but will extend to feelings of solidarity in a military sense as well. You might find that the Brits are less willing to countenance offering help to NATO allies because they're seen as the people who brought us to a no deal outcome. So that's the key thing for me, avoiding no deal. I think no deal is very dangerous and very problematic. It's very, very hard to see, given our current political leaders. The leader of the Labour Party is not exactly a Euro-federalist. The Conservative Party has a whole bunch, 20 or so prospective new leaders, very few of whom voted Remain. There's some new polling out today that puts you know, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, Dominic Raab up there ahead of people who supported Remain. I think we're in for a turbulent period of UK-EU relations if we leave. That being said, it's very hard to see at the moment how you muster a parliamentary majority for us leaving, because there is absolutely no parliamentary majority for us leaving with no deal. This goes back to what you were saying, Andrea said. The fact of the matter is Parliament doesn't want any outcome at the moment, and there's a majority against every outcome. So as we move towards October, I think it might be, I mean, two things. One, I suspect we'll end up having a general election. We don't know what will happen in a general election. It looks at the moment as if a general election will create another hung parliament. Who knows? We might have a general election and find ourselves in exactly the same Brexit impasse as we were in before it, which would be interesting, if nothing else. But at that point, I think people will start saying, look, we need to put this to the Brexit back to the British people, because there is no other obvious way out of this dilemma. Now, I think a referendum is potentially quite dangerous and damaging. I think a campaign based on the fact that the politicians are trying to overturn the will of the people will be poisonous, ugly, and harmful for politics. That being said, it might actually end up being the most plausible outcome if all the others have been exhausted by the time we get to autumn.
And you reckon this all can play out until October?
I reckon it could quite easily play out until October, yeah. I mean, I don't know. What I don't know yet, and I have a certain personal vested interest in this, is how much Brexit will dominate our political life between now and October. That is to say, after the European elections, maybe people will talk about something else. Maybe people will go on holiday. Who knows? But I think we can quite easily keep this hanging on until October, because actually can kicking is not just a speciality of our prime minister. It's also something I fear that Parliament might find quite useful too, given the lack of a majority for any of the outcomes.
All right. And let's finish. Gosh, we've already been more than half an hour.
Time fly when you're having fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can probably forget about your holiday, given the Brexit schedule. But
which I've just had to cancel one because of the European elections.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, there you go. More of this to come, I'm afraid. But let me finish on an unusual question. Mm-hmm. If you had to liken the Brexit process, as you see it, to a song or a movie, what would it be?
God, I think I'd almost say The Day After Tomorrow, because it never comes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Might have also been a good one. So. Okay, Anand.
How about Wish You Were Here?
Wish You Were Here, also a good one. Anand, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about Brexit.
Nice talking to you.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.